You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY. DIY.
Oh. Musician.
Musician. Podcast.
Hey there, this is episode number 132 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner. I'll be your host for the show. And before I dive into the intro for today's interview, I wanted to remind you that we love getting your comments and feedback. We use those to drive much of the discussion for our roundtable edition of the podcast, and that's where I'm joined by Chris and The Bolt to discuss news and the topics at hand for the day. So I wanted to be sure you knew all the ways you can connect with us. One of the best ways is in the comments section for each episode. Those are found at cdbabypodcast.com. You can also email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209. We love getting phone calls. Those are great. And you can also connect with me directly on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @kbruner. So on to today's episode. We'll be talking to Mike King from the Berklee Online School. Mike has held numerous positions in the music industry, but now finds himself running the Berklee Online School. Mike writes course material and teaches classes mostly geared around music marketing, which is something artists are always asking us about here at CD Baby. So I know you'll enjoy our conversation. Also, if you're not familiar with Berklee Online, it's the online school from the famed Berklee College of Music in Boston. You'll hear more about it in our conversation, so let's get to my interview with Mike. Well, joining me on the line is Mike King from the Berklee Online School. Mike, how you doing?
I'm great, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to have you on the podcast. It's been cool getting to know you over the past, I guess, like 2 years. We've been kind of connecting online and have joined in on a couple of your classes, and it's good to have you on our podcast. So,
no, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I'm such a fan of what you're doing specifically, but what CD Baby is doing kind of globally. You guys have been wonderful to work with, so I'm really happy to do this.
Well, excellent. Well, why don't you start us off with some of your background and music marketing and how you got involved with Berklee and just what you're doing there, and then we can kind of launch into the conversation after that.
Sure. I could make this intro really long, but I'm going to give an abbreviated version. So, I am a fair musician, maybe not even fair. I play guitar and bass, but I'm more a music consumer big time. You know, in college, I did some music writing. I had a good collection of music, and I wanted to figure out a way to make music part of my life, and I just didn't have the skills to go out there and play. So the route I took was at a record label. So right out of college, I worked at a label that was in Massachusetts called Ryko Disc. It was in Salem, Massachusetts. It was this wonderful place where I did a variety of things, you know. So I started, like I think many people do in the industry, as an unpaid intern. And I kind of worked my way around. I wouldn't say I worked my way up. I started in the radio promotions department. And Ryko Disc catalog was so amazing. I was working right when I got there. Modesky Martin and Woods' Shackman record, which was on Grammavision, right? And it went to number one on the jazz chart for CMJ when I was there. So I had like an early win, but it was this, the music was right up my alley. Another artist I was working on when I was there was Ali Farka Touré, this amazing guitar player from Mali, from Timbuktu. So I started working in the radio promo department, and then I moved into finance. You know, I sort of just looked for openings and took them. So I did a variety of things in the finance department at Ryko Disc. I was responsible for consignment reporting, you know, so that's Ryko Disc distributed maybe at the time 20 or 25 labels. So I reported back to the labels on their sales. I did royalty accounting, you know, all sorts of, you know, what many people might think is kind of dry, but I absolutely loved it. I loved seeing how things worked from a finance side. And then, you know, Chris Blackwell bought Ryko Disc in 1999. And when he bought Ryko Disc, Ryko sort of split a little bit, and the bulk of the label, at least the employees, moved to New York City. So when I moved to New York, I started doing marketing, which is really where I wanted to be. I did tour marketing for a period of time, and I came back to Massachusetts, again, continuing to work at Rykodisc. It was a much smaller version of Rykodisc, and I was a product manager. And that was just a dream job. A product manager at a label is basically the quarterback, you know? So somebody that would be given a finished master, and sometimes the master wasn't even finished, you know? I would have to master, you know, some recordings, but I would be, you know, given a recording and work with all of the key areas within the label to put a plan together and be the main point of contact between the label and the manager and sometimes the artists. And it was just an incredible education to be working very closely with the retail department, you know, the online department, the press department, the distribution company. So it was really wonderful, you know, but, you know, all good things come to an end. And Ryko, there's actually one employee that still is sort of involved with Ryko from when I was working there in the 90s and the early 2000s, but it more or less kind of disappeared. It's a sub-label of Warner right now, Rykodisc is. I don't know how many employees are still there, but I basically left in 2003. I worked at Rounder for a period of time doing publishing administration for the publishing company called Happy Valley, and I had some interesting experiences working with Studio One, which is a Jamaican label run by a guy named Sir Coxone Dodd, and there were very unusual publishing kind of issues that I was looking into for a short period of time. And then I came to Berkeley in mid-2003, right at the start of Berkeley's online school. So I've been involved in online education since 2003 in a couple of different ways. I wrote four of the online music courses for Berkeley. You know, they're focused on music marketing and music business. I wrote one book for Berkeley Press, and I now run the sales and marketing for Berklee College of Music's online school. So that's kind of my background in a nutshell, I suppose.
Wow, so you've been in quite a few different departments around the music business and have seen a lot of different things for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the hands-on experience was just, you know, really invaluable. To be the role of the product manager is just such a critical gig, you know. And at Ryko, when I was doing that, there was some degree of flexibility. I was involved in bringing some artists to the label that ended up getting signed. One band is called The Slip, you know, in the late 90s. And I worked with, was kind of a little bit of a, I don't know if I want to say hippie, but I knew the people that, you know, Fish Management, and we signed Pork Tornado, which was John Fishman, the drummer of Fish's band. And I brought those guys to Ryko. So it was just, it was a really great time, I suppose. And the gig specifically allowed me just to get a real kind of wealth of experience about how things worked.
So I guess what's, to me, it's kind of interesting hearing your experience and just the era of the industry you came up in. And
yeah.
I can only imagine, and I can guess that the way you think about marketing has changed quite a bit since those days with the change of the industry. Is that a correct assumption?
It is a correct assumption. It's not only the way that I think about it, but the tools that exist and the way that, and I suppose what is possible now. It wasn't possible back then. You know, the major shift from a marketing standpoint is that marketing was somewhat reactive and not super data-driven back in the day. So really what we would do is, there are various things you could look at, various ways to measure how you were doing. You know, if you hired a radio promo indie, you'd get, you know, weekly reports or daily updates, you know, that sort of thing on what station was playing a record, how often they were playing it, that sort of thing. But the main tool we used to determine how we were doing was SoundScan, you know. So that tool still exists, but back in the day it was one weekly meeting on Tuesday, I believe, is when the SoundScan reports came out. And, you know, the marketing staff would sit around, we'd look at SoundScan, and we'd say, oh, look at this spike, you know, in Denver. You know, we should connect with Twist and Shout and see what else we could do at that retail location, you know. But it was very reactive. And it was difficult to test, you know. So the main changes now are the tools are different, you know, that can allow you to test, to allow you to look at things. And then pretty much the whole landscape has adjusted in terms of being proactive, you know, as opposed to being reactive with what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with in the marketing world that you definitely now have the tools that can connect and help you kind of, you know, use data better and almost in real time these days.
That's true.
So I assume that a lot of people coming, or a good portion of the people coming to your classes at Berkeley, are artists that are wanting to learn more about marketing. Some that probably want to get into the business to work at a company, and some that probably want to learn how to better market their music. What are some of the key issues that you would say a lot of these people coming to your classes are facing and kind of trying to figure out in their minds?
Yeah, and you're right. There's a cross section of people that are taking the courses. There are definitely musicians in there that are trying to figure out how to make it. You know, how to generate visibility for themselves and how to sell, you know, their music. And then there are people that want to work in the industry. And those aren't two. It's not kind of an either or thing. It's sort of like, you know, you have to learn both of those skills if you want to do either of those things, you know? So the biggest issues, and this is something that we talk about quite a bit, you know, people come into the class and they want to sell, you know, or oftentimes, okay, how do I make money doing this, you know? And to me, something I talk about in the class too is that's sort of the, in many ways, the last thing you should be focused on, right? It should be, and this goes without saying, but I'm going to say it now, you have to have good product. You have to be able to write good songs. And it, you know, if you can play out live, that's, you know, very positive too. If you're not performing out, it makes things a little bit more difficult. You know, so many things, you know, get kickstarted from touring. So those are the, you know, before you do anything, you have to have those things together. But it's, you know, for me, it's more focused on how do you make people aware of what you're doing, you know? So I have kind of these four horsemen that I think you kind of have to focus on. It's awareness, acquisition, engagement, and then monetization, right? So, you know, once you've got great product, you can play and all that. There's a pro and a con to all of these tools that are out there to help people. There's more competition than there ever has been, you know, so marketing is more important. And, you know, finding ways to make people even aware of you, that's very difficult, you know. And once people are aware of you, how do you get a permission-based contact happening? You know, this is something I talk about in all the courses a lot because it's so fundamental. You know, and this is, you know, back in the day when I was at Ryko, it was about almost like it might be called like a shotgun approach to marketing. Just making, you know, radio as an example, you kind of don't know who's hearing. There's some measurements, but it's difficult, and it's a one-time hit, and then you've got nothing else. With acquisition, if you can obtain some permission-based contact where then you control that relationship moving forward, you know, and probably the best example of that is an email address still to this day, 2014 email, you know, that's really important. And then once you are engaging properly, you know, then it's time to think about monetization. Once you've had a community, you've built up a community, you're talking to them properly, you have this relationship, then think about monetization. So that's sort of like, oftentimes people come in right away. How do I generate revenue? And that's, again, one of the last things I think you should be thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that that, you know, everybody wants to make money from their music, but oftentimes artists get a little ahead of themselves. And, you know, any other business type transaction, you're going to spend time developing the product, kind of figuring out a story and all this kind of stuff, then kind of launch out into, you know, building an audience and then ultimately trying to find the sales. So,
I mean, and you probably have some detail on this. I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I forget what number tracks are in iTunes that have never been listened to. And I think somebody built a program actually that is designed to, or an app that goes on Spotify and only plays songs that have been listened zero times, you know? So, I mean, there's, and it's a super high percentage of songs that have never been listened to. So these are folks that aren't focused on that awareness part yet. They focus solely on the monetization before maybe they were ready.
Yeah, that app, I want to throw out that it was like something like 75% or something. It was something pretty big that tracks on Spotify that hadn't had a stream yet, and somebody did build an app for it. But
yeah,
but yeah. So when an artist is, you know, finishing up with their product, what in your mind is one of the first things they should start doing as they sort of transition out of music creation mode into now I need to get this out to the world? What are some of the first steps they should be taking?
Right. So I have kind of a linear graph in one of my classes that outlines what can be called a serialized approach to releasing content, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think you should be focused on acquisition all the time. You know, the biggest artists in the world should still be focused on acquisition. But I really like the idea of, if you've got something recorded, I think you can utilize free, right, to help you with that awareness part. You can generate all sorts of derivatives of your content even before release, you know? So I might bounce around a little bit here with this answer, but
that's okay. I'm
friendly with the folks that run Pledge Music, and I really like that idea of, you know, and even taking it back before what you said. So engaging your fans even before the product is there, right? Even before you've got something finalized for sale, you know? So what Pledge Music does is it allows you to communicate with fans throughout the whole recording process, you know, and you're engaging and you can, you know, give your fans something special. So that can happen, you know, with Pledge Music, and it can happen without Pledge Music, parts of that, you know, where, you know, if you've got that community, you're looking at your content, you're creating things, you're kind of floating things out there. And going back to data and analysis, you can even utilize some widgets to test out singles. And maybe, you know, you're recording stuff. And somebody that does this really well, I think, is Anton Newcomb from the Brian Jonestown Massacre. He's putting out things on YouTube all the time. And I don't know what his thought process is behind it, but...
You know, he's a character, I can tell you that.
Oh, so yeah. I mean, he's a complete character. And I listened to his... I mean, we could do a whole podcast about what he's doing. I listened to Dead TV, this little program that he does, you know. But anyways, he's putting out, you know, it's clearly unfinished material, right? And he's floating it on YouTube where he has this community of people that are commenting. Folks are, you know, sharing this stuff. So I love that idea of, even before you've got something totally finished, kind of connecting with your community to say, hey, what do you think? And maybe not explicitly saying, what do you think, but floating things out there and seeing what people freak out over, you know? And I don't know what Anton was thinking, and I'd love to talk with him someday. But, you know, the record that came out after, you know, his last record, you know, it led with the song that I think was the one that was most highly received, right? So on YouTube, right? So did he use that data to determine what the sequencing would be on the record? Maybe, you know, if I was him or working with him, that's exactly what I would do. So sorry, like I said, it's kind of a roundabout answer, but I think there's a lot that can be done even before you've got a totally finished thing to engage and to generate information for you to help you move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're looking at some of these tools out there, I know that artists sometimes feel inundated with tools that help them market their music. From whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, there seems like there's always something new popping up that people are being told, hey, you should use this great new tool to market your music. What do you think are some key tools that they should start with? Or if there's one thing that they need to do, what is it?
Sure. So one thing I would recommend, and you're exactly right, there are things popping up all the time. And the difficulty, and what I try to do is be a you know, and this term is getting overused, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to say it. I try to be a curator. You know, that term is totally overused, especially now with streaming and all that. But it's accurate, right? So the first thing I would suggest people do is try to find some people that you think are good curators that can help guide the way, right? Mm-hmm. So there's so many outlets out there that you can use to kind of separate the bad from the good and get a bit more clarity on what really you should be paying attention to. So there's something I refer to in my class. You know, so I try to be a curator and I stay on top of things and I get a bunch of information, you know, and I can talk about some of the stuff that I use. Actually, I will right now. You know, I like that guy Ari's take. And he actually did a very fair assessment of CD Baby Pro and TuneCore, their publishing option, you know. So, and he did it. He went through and he talked to people. I think he talked to you, you know.
He did.
So I try to find curators first. So I use, you know, Music Ally is another one that I subscribe to, and everyone gets the Left Sets report. And there, you know, there's all of these folks out. I think Glenn Peoples is excellent, you know, Billboard.biz. And, I have, a column set up in Twitter that is only dedicated to people that I have deemed curators. And that's the stuff that I pay attention to, you know? So before even talking about what tools to use, because I think it's different depending on where you're at in your career, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's finding the right people that are speaking to you, you know, that you can look to help guide you, you know. So I have let's see here. I've created a list on my Twitter of people. This is for a course that I taught in Northeastern. And I said, you know, I've actually kind of dropped off on Twitter. I have to get back on it. But there are people that are very active that are very good, you know. So that's the first thing. And then in terms of other tools, I do think it's valuable to look at two different things. I think that there are good self-service options out there to help you do things online. And that's kind of a wonky way of saying it, but I'm paying attention to companies like StageBlock. I'm paying attention to companies like NoiseTrade. You know, I'm looking at sites that help you, like Section 101. That's a website company. And I have no, you know, I don't work for any of these companies, so I'm not endorsing them. I'm not doing buzz marketing right now, but these are really companies that are interesting to me, you know, that I think are in it for the right reasons. Bandcamp. You know, I have the luxury of working at Berkeley, and sometimes people would take my calls, you know. So I've met, like, Ethan Diamond runs Bandcamp, Jay Sider runs Bandpage. These are excellent people. Ethan Diamond is just a great person that's in it for the right reasons, you know. So that's something that's important to me, is, you know, connecting with these companies, that the people that are running these companies are solid people that are really in it to help forward musicians' careers, because that's why I do it. I love talking about this stuff, and, like, there's no better feeling to help a musician, like, you know, move forward, right? There's a number of different companies that I think are doing great things, but it's, like, it's kind of too many to list right now, you know. But I guess what I've said off the top of my head right there are folks that I would recommend other folks look into.
I know you're a big advocate of artists sending all their fans, directing their fans and using their website, their main band or artist website, and using that as the hub of their marketing. Do you think that's one place where artists are not doing or taking advantage of the opportunity that they have there with their fans?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I am an advocate of that, and I've gotten into debates with folks that work at companies that no longer exist that suggested, "Well, just send them to Facebook. Your fans are on Facebook. That's all you want to do." I mean, at the end of the day, you own the relationship with your fans. Number one, you own the experience with your fans. If you're sending them to your own site, you don't. We saw what happened when Facebook changed the way that they operated into timeline, right?
Yeah.
So, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I think some of the opportunity relates to organic SEO too. You know, with your site, and Bandpage is kind of an out of the box service, but they were built in a way that it's very optimized for SEO. So I like what they're doing a lot, but there are so many, there's a lot of opportunity, I suppose, with organic search. And I've done this myself. And again, it sounds like I'm doing buzz marketing. I don't mean to, but like I wrote this book, music marketing book. And if you Google music marketing book, my book comes up usually number one, right? So there's something around that. There are different things that I've done there to help with that response and different, and you can get very in depth. There's a guy named Matt Cutts who works at CUTTS, who works at Google, that he's kind of like the oracle of organic SEO. I would suggest people follow Matt Cutts, but that's something, number one, yeah, definitely having your own web presence. Looking at tools that you can use on your website, understanding analytics around your website, and then understanding how organic search works so that if somebody is searching for you or something like you, you return high in the search results.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I know artists, it can be SEO is like a whole, it's a whole podcast of its own.
Yeah, it is.
A whole series of podcasts. In fact, there are some. If you're interested, you can go listen to. But yeah, it's one of those things that artists don't realize that, you know, when you control your own website, when you put content in one place, it actually helps people find you, and also it makes it easier for them to get your music. I mean, honestly, I get frustrated. When I went to South by Southwest this year, there were some bands that I was going to check out, some that were on a label, and I went to their website, and there was literally no information, not even about any of their tour dates, anything. And it was basically just a link to iTunes, which, you know, if that's all I was looking for, that's fine. But then they were sending me to Facebook for tour dates. And then I'm digging around on Facebook trying to find it. And I finally forget about it. I don't care anymore.
Think how hard it was for you to even become a fan. Like, so they got you with the awareness part. You're aware of them, right? But where in what you're describing right now, where they failed is acquisition. And there's a whole, you know, you could do a whole podcast on IA, information architecture, you know, like how you organize your site, you know, and, you know, depending on what stage you're at within like an album release cycle, that's a wonky way to put it. But like, you know, if you've got a record coming up soon, you want to put that information front and center. If you're focused on touring, you want your tour dates front and center. That it should be like a living, working thing, you know? So yeah, totally. I'm trying to think right now. I used to use this example. There's a band on a label called Thrill Jockey, and it's not coming to me right now. Their website, when I taught at Northeastern, I'd bring this band's website up and just say, This is like what not to do, you know, like no navigation, trying to be cutesy. I think the URL had nothing to do with the band, you know, no SEO to speak of. There's some horrible, horrible things out there. So, and there's tons of resources. Like I'm going to go back and check out your podcast on organic SEO just to check that out. I think, you know, Banzoogle, they do website demolition stuff. David Dufresne, those guys do some really neat things. So yeah, going back to what I would suggest in terms of tools and best practices, definitely the web stuff should be high on the list.
Yeah, yeah. So with we're talking about some of the fan engagement. Is there any things or techniques or the acquisition, I should say, that you've been talking about in your classes, or things that you have your eye on as interesting ways artists or record companies or anyone who's trying to engage and build fans have been doing lately?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And it's a hard question because everything is so specific to an individual band, right? So what works with one band isn't necessarily going to work with the other. Because the demographic and psychographic is different, you know? So overall, I'm more impressed when I see a band that's doing like best practices in a certain vertical, you know? So there is, oh man, I'm spacing on band names right now, but it's on the tip of my tongue and I can't remember. Email marketing, that's something that bands can do very poorly or very well. And there is a band that I can't recall. Maybe I'll remember it. But somebody that I hired to teach this course that I wrote on Topspin software was involved in this band. And we were having a conversation about email marketing. And he said, yeah, their open rate is over 100%. And I said, well, how's that even possible? How do you get more? He's already told me it's over 100%. And he said it's because of shares, right? And still it sounds a little funny to me, but he says, you know, the email goes out to X number of people and the subject line and content is consistently so good that people are sharing this thing like crazy. And then again, it's a little bit of a funny way to look at it. But I'm impressed by that. So bands that have figured out exactly what works with their own community in a way that the community is sharing on their behalf. You know, there's an idea by this guy named Clay Shirky called participatory culture. You know, so there are many examples of participatory culture. But if you can put a foundation together that is something upon which your fans can build and start spreading the word. You know, like this is an older example, but something I really love that involves Creative Commons. There was a band that was on network called Chaos, K-OS. And I loved this from an engagement standpoint, where before his record was even out, he released some stems for one of the songs out to his fans and said, all right, guys, this is, you know, I forget which flavor of Creative Commons license he gave it, but he said, you know, remix this, you know, pass it around. And there was a contest related to it. And I forget how he measured who got the most interest in this, in their remix. But the end result was the best remix, the one that got shared the most or whatever it was, got added onto the record that wasn't even out yet. I hope I'm making sense with this, right? So stems from an unreleased record put out there, the fan-created remix got onto a record without the fan even hearing the original, you know? Like, I love that. I mean, that what an amazing way to engage your fans first off, but then use that idea of participatory culture for them to kind of help you market, you know? That sort of thing is what impresses me.
Do you find that artists are sometimes scared of marketing or trying to build that kind of engagement? And the, I guess I'm coming from the angle of, you know, here at, you know, both of us work in marketing. So what a lot of people who don't work in marketing may not know is that we fail a lot and we then go, huh, well, that didn't work. Well, let's change this and try it again. Oh, that did work. And now we are getting better responses from our email. I find like a lot of artists tend to like send out an email and maybe get a so-so response and just go, well, I guess nobody likes me. And not understand that you're using a communication platform, that it takes time and effort to kind of tweak and test things.
That's it, you know. So I think there's a couple of things. You know, I teach this course called Music Business Trends and Strategies, and the lesson on marketing was last night, you know. So it's, you know, I had an hour-long chat about marketing last night, and some of the folks that were in the chat were saying, you know, number one, wow, I didn't really realize all of this. And number two, how do you find the time to do all of this? That's the major thing, I think, is because you're right. I'm testing all the time, you know, and with what we're doing at Berkeley, I mean, it's very in depth, as I'm sure it is for CD Baby, you know. So we have nurture campaigns. We use a marketing automation software, you know. I mean, we have a CRM, you know, and I'm going to go on a tangent again for a second, but like one thing that I thought was so interesting about the last South by Southwest, and I don't know if you saw Lady Gaga's keynote. Were you there?
I did not see it, but I did watch it online later.
So she said, and I don't know who caught this, but I tweeted it. She uses Salesforce. Lady Gaga uses Salesforce, right? So she's like, yeah, you know, I'm up to date with all. And Salesforce is this heavy duty customer relationship management software, CRM, you know? And I'm like, whoa. And from what I could tell, like, she uses it. Like, she goes into Salesforce to, like, you know, split up her lists and communicate with people effectively. So, I mean, going back to, like, you know, folks being scared, I think it's less about that. I think it's daunting, you know? It's like, there is so much to do that in many ways, it depends on, again, where you're at in your career, but when you're at a certain point, you have to have some people to help you with this. It's just unrealistic. You'll drown, you know, if you try to do everything possible. There's tons of best practices, but if you're responsible for writing, booking your own shows, you know, recording, producing, all of that, there comes a point where you hit a wall, I think, you know. So marketing is one thing that, again, once when you're starting off, like you're doing it all, right? But once you reach a certain point, it makes a lot of sense to even elevate one of your fans. Hey, do you want to handle my web, you know, or something like that? I just and the person that was talking last night about this being daunting, you're exactly right. Like, I kind of laid everything out. Like, here's, you know, best practices. You know, this guy got 105% open rate. You know, but like, really, like, can one person do all of this? Mm-hmm. And it's a good question. It's difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got to wrap up soon. So I was wondering if you had any final pieces of advice that you might want to leave us with, and then you can tell us about how artists can find out more about what you guys are doing over there at Berkeley and the cool classes you guys offer and all that.
Oh, thanks for that, and thanks so much for having me on here. I love this topic. you know, I enjoyed talking with you, and I've been a fan of your podcast for some time. So I'm really happy to be part of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's really. Geez. I mean, the sort of thing that I want to say is the stuff that has helped me to continue on, right? So when I reflect back on how I've gone through the industry and done different things, it's being tenacious, you know, and it's looking for opportunities. And, you know, there's stuff that I didn't mention that I've done, nothing horrible. But, you know, it's sometimes, you know, when I was an unpaid intern at Rykodisc, the truth is half of the time I was working at a mutual fund company called Zurich as a registered representative. That was my real job right out of school. Right. So part time was doing that. Part time was, you know, doing what I loved. Right. So maybe that would be my advice is it's. And I've said this before, there's a philosopher who masquerades as a cartoonist named Hugh MacLeod, and he's got this theory called the sex and cash theory, right? Where, you know, when you're starting off, you're doing things for cash, and in your spare time, you're doing the stuff you really love. And best case scenario is all of your time at some point morphs into doing what you love all the time. But it's a long road, and it's a hard road, and you're going to hit you know, walls and everything. But like I said, when I reflect back, I tried to see an opportunity and some sunlight and a path and make my way towards that path for my own particular goal, you know, and everybody's goal is different. Not everybody's goal is to be international, you know, pop superstar, right? So I really had my sights set on, I want to work in the industry and I want to learn as much as possible. And this is how I'm going to do it, you know, and try to find those opportunities. I think the very same thing that process could be similar for artists, you know? So I don't want to say, don't give up, stay with it. But I do. That really is it. You know, I mean, if you feel passionate about what you're doing and you're on this earth to do this thing, find a way. You might be doing other things alongside of it. You know, find a way.
Well, I agree. I think that's good advice, because I think a lot of artists, especially now what we see in the media, seems like everyone that becomes big is an overnight success. They were on American Idol for 6 months. Now they're selling platinum records.
Yeah.
All right. And this idea that there was no long road that got them there. And, you know, a lot of the artists that we see popping up here that, oh, they're an overnight sensation. They're like, yeah, it was a 9-year overnight sensation.
Totally. Absolutely. You know, I saw that firsthand with this band called Carmen, where I was working. Amy Heidemann is in Carmen, the duo. She, you know, she's obviously the female singer. And she worked with me at Berkeley, and she was a Berkeley student here. And I would, you know, lightly consult with her, you know, for a really long time. But the word on the street is, they did one cover on YouTube of a Chris Brown video. It got, you know, 40 million views, and they got signed by L.A. Reid to Sony. That's not really it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are true musicians that, I mean, they went to Berkeley. They, you know, spent years, and they had a very focused approach to how they wanted to break based on the work of this amazing manager. You know, they're working with a guy named Nils Gum, sorry. And he's excellent, right? But they – it was years, right? But like, it's funny you say that, because I hear that all the time too. Like, oh, it's an overnight sensation, just happened. It's never like that.
Yeah. But I do like what you mentioned and kind of alluding to the idea of having an intentional path, something that you know you're shooting for. And I think that's a lot of times where artists kind of lose hope in ever being able to do something with their music, is because they, when they think about it, they don't even know what they're shooting for. It's just like, well, I want success or whatever. But I think it's when you have more of an intentional path, you can see those opportunities pop up and go, that's going to help me get to where I want to go, and I'm going that direction. So
that's well put. That's true. And I think education is important too, and understanding the landscape.
Which brings us to, how can we find out about Berkeley?
Yeah. I truly do, but you're doing it too right now. Yeah, what you're doing right now with CDB, this is education, and this is it.
Yep. Yeah. So, how you guys do offer some really cool classes there, and how can people find out about what you're doing? And you might also want to explain the difference between the Berklee Online School and Berklee College of Music, because there was a while I didn't even really know there was a difference, but you might want to highlight the difference between those two.
Yeah. So I'm. You know, that's my job, is to make people aware of the difference, or the fact that we exist. So Berklee College of Music has existed here in the Back Bay of Boston since the mid-40s, you know. So the college has been around forever, very progressive, amazing people have went to Berklee. In 2002, Gary Burton and Lee Burke, the president at the time, decided that they wanted to get an online school happening, and they did. I mean, it was a very forward-thinking idea to think, you know, if you think back to 2002, there were no online music schools, you know. We exist to bring Berklee faculty, Berklee curriculum to people that can't come to the Back Bay, and the experiences are different. It's amazing here in Boston in the Back Bay. Berklee has amazing facilities. There are things that happen on campus that can't happen online. There's an amazing new building that's here that has just state-of-the-art, like the best studios in the country, you know, are going to open, later on this year. So amazing things. The online school, bringing Berklee faculty, Berklee curriculum to everybody. We have courses, 12-week online, 4-credit and non-credit courses available. We've got multi-course certificate programs, so you could study, you can become an absolute expert in Pro Tools, as an example, and study with Berklee for several years. And we just launched online Bachelor of Professional Studies degrees in music business and music production, and those are going to start in September. So you can get an online degree from Berklee College of Music in those two areas. It's a Bachelor of Professional Studies degree, so that's something we're all very, very excited about. And I'm very involved in that in a couple of different ways. You know, some of the courses that I wrote and that I teach are going to be part of the business track, you know, of the Bachelor of Professional Studies. I wrote a course called Online Music Marketing, and it has a bunch of words after that, but it's Online Music Marketing, Campaign Strategies, Digital Distribution, and Social Media. I think that's the name of the course. Music Business Trends and Strategies is one that I wrote, which is sort of like a all-encompassing, you know, we talk about copyright, we talk about publishing, we talk about fan funding. And then I wrote a course called Music Marketing 101. So I work with some amazing instructors to teach some of the courses that I wrote, people that are doing fantastic things in the industry. I have people like you come in as special guests who are experts in their field. So it's something that, and I said this earlier, maybe I didn't, but I meant to. I feel so lucky to have the opportunity. And it's really an honor to be able to meet with people weekly, you know, and we have these hour-long chats where I'm on video and audio and screen sharing and everything, and just going through exactly what's going on right now. And kind of what I was saying earlier, finding the paths for individuals, you know, it's something that I love and I'm enthusiastic about. So I feel very lucky to have the opportunity to talk to people literally around the world. People are taking, you know, I had somebody from Kenya in my last course, that in the last term. But it's an amazing opportunity. I love teaching it. There's a good community that grows online as well. So I feel pretty lucky to be part of it.
And when do the courses typically start? Because they are like more like a traditional course. They do have specific start times, correct?
That's right. We have four terms. We have four terms a year. The next is beginning of July, and then the term that starts with the online degree programs is in September. That's the end of September. So four terms a year. After that, it's beginning of January, and then beginning of April. Like I said, the courses are 12 weeks long. So that we build in a couple of weeks, kind of a vacation time, you know, in between terms. Yeah, it's been, I've been doing it since 2007. I can't believe how time goes by so quickly.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's like second nature, you know. It's I've been teaching constantly for 7 years.
Wow.
I mean, it's just amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast, Mike. We'll put some links in on the podcast show notes that get people over if they want to check out more about the classes and what you guys are doing over there at Berkeley. Lots of cool stuff, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Thanks so much, Kevin. And like I said, I really appreciate you having me on. And we so respect and admire the work that you're doing and the work that CD Baby is doing, too. So thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
Take care.
Yep. Take it easy, man.
All right. You too. Bye.
Bye. Thanks again to Mike King for joining me on the podcast. If you'd like to find out more about what they're doing over at Berkeley Online, we'll have a link in the show notes. They have some great classes. And if you use our link, you'll get a 10% discount off the class fee. We've actually been sending some of the CD Baby crew to their classes to get some deeper training on topics like music publishing, so check those out. Again, if you want to weigh in with comments or feedback, please do so. I mentioned all the ways you can contact us at the top of the show, and that should do it for this episode. We'll catch you next time.